Thanks, Glenn. It's a real pleasure to be here, back in Toronto again, and I'd like to thank the organizers for organizing this terrific event. So I'll be giving you, hopefully not that random, but thoughts about random knotting. I'll be talking about some theory and some applications. So I'll be talking about two things, the theory in which Stu was heavily involved, the proof of the Fish-Wasserman-Delbruck conjecture, and then some more recent work that I've been involved in on looking at DNA knotting in viruses. So here's a picture of the knot zoo. You can think of knots as flexible circles in three-dimensional space, and these circles are investigating the complexity of three-space and encoding it in a discrete manner. So this is the unknot. That's the open circle you can lay down in the plane. This is the simplest knot. It has three crossings in this projection. So that's a picture of this object sitting in three-space. It's a two-dimensional representation, a knot diagram, and it crosses itself three times. That's the first knot. You can stratify knots according to crossover number, the best picture you can get for them. This knot is chiral because it has an enantiomer. If you take its mirror image in three space, you get a different knot. And two knots are equivalent if and only if you can take one and smoothly deform it to the other one without passing the knot through itself or breaking it and reconnecting it. This is a four-crossing knot, a figure eight knot, and it is achiral, so it's equivalent to its own mirror image. And here's some five-crossing knots. This is a five-crossing torus knot. You can draw it on a nice round torus. And this is a five-crossing twist knot. So it has this clasp in it so that if you move it through itself, it becomes unknotted. Here's a six-crossing twist knot, a seven-crossing torus knot, and a seven-crossing twist knot. And, of course, you can go up in complexity. It's known that the number of knots and links, which are cat names, grow exponentially with crossover number. So I'm going to be talking about topological entanglement in polymers, because polymers live in three-space and they can become entangled. And the entanglement has a lot of ramifications, especially in biology. I mean, it's known recently, there's an experiment that I've been involved with in bacteria that showed that if you take a bacterium where you've got a plasmid in it that has a gene on it that codes for resistance to ampicillin, if this plasmid is knotted, it's a lethal event for the cell. The cell dies. It's also mutagenic. It also interferes with replication. So knotting has serious consequences in the cell. And topological entanglement in the cell is something that has to be fixed. And topological entanglement, of course, occurs in polymers as well, because here we have sort of an unknotted but supercoiled circle, and here we've got a linear polymer that's supercoiled like a phone cord. So these are kind of geometric measures of entanglement called writhing. You can have knotting, which is this topological thing. This is a knotted, this is the figure eight knot, and here's a knot in a long linear polymer. You can also have linking between curves and between linear chains as well. So we're going to be interested in how this topological entanglement scales, So here's some of the justification that I've talked about. And in particular in biopolymers, you can measure this knotting, and many times you can look at random knotting as noise in an experiment. You may have an enzyme or something that produces a specific family of DNA knots, and you'd like to know that it's not a random distribution. So you have to be able to detect what a random distribution looks like, and in some cases maybe subtract it to see the signal, take it away from the noise. So we're going to be interested in, for example, computing the yield in a random cyclization experiment where you take linear polymers in dilute solution and the ends of the polymers have affinity for each other. And when you do a cyclization experiment, you may get knotted products, unknotted products. You may get catenated products. You may also get dimers and trimers and so on. We'd like to be able to predict the spectrum of product from a cyclization reaction, given knowledge about the length of the substrate. So if L is the length of a linear polymer in dilute solution, you'd like to know what the yield is, the spectrum of topological products from such a random cyclization reaction. And you can take L as the number of Kuhn links or the number of monomers. For example, for duplex DNA, the Kuhn links are about 300 to 500 base pairs for DNA in dilute solution, duplex DNA. So here's a conjecture I came across a number of years ago. Actually, I looked it up. I mean, I found it in papers of Frisch and Wasserman and Jax in 1961 and Max Delbruck. Thank you. This one advances and this one points. Okay, Stu, I'll hand. Where's the button?
I
the clicker. Gotcha, thank you. So this is the obvious conjecture, that if you take L as the number of edges in a random polygon and PL is the knot probability, that this probability goes to 1 as L goes to infinity. And so it's Murphy's Law for polymers. The longer it is, the more likely it is to be knotted. This is where Stu Whittington comes into the picture, because I went to a symposium on computation and mathematical chemistry in Saskatoon and presented this conjecture. So I had the nail, the Frisch-Wassermann-Delbruck conjecture. Along comes the hammer, Keston's pattern theorem. So I gave this talk, and after this guy was in the audience, and he said, "Hey, have you heard of Keston's pattern theorem?" I said, "Who the hell is Keston?" So he came up afterwards, and sure enough, that was it, the technique, the one I needed. So with Keston's pattern theorem, and it took us a couple of years. I mean, we had to do some rough mathematics. We had to go to Dubrovnik and, you know, hang our feet in the surf and go to the nude beach and stuff and get a theorem out of this. So finally, after all this hard work, we actually got a proof, and it was lucky we did, because Nick Pippinger had essentially the same proof at the same time. So we just pipped him at the post. So we're able to prove that the probability goes to 1 exponentially rapidly with the length. And here's a rough idea of the proof. A Keston pattern theorem is one that you can wire in series in a self-avoiding walk. It has to occur at least 3 times in a long self-avoiding walk. That means that there's a way in and a way out of a specific pattern. So we're doing this proof in the simple cubic lattice, Z3. And it uses this theorem of Keston, which was around essentially at the same time that Frisch and Wassermann and Delbruck made the conjecture. The idea of the proof, and Keston's pattern theorem is very powerful. It says that given any Keston pattern, there's a density associated with it, so that almost all exponentially long self-avoiding polygons have the pattern a number of times, alpha times the length. So this, it appears with a certain density. So all you need to do is you need to get a Keston pattern such that if it appears in a self-avoiding polygon at least 1 time, then the polygon's guaranteed to be knotted. And for that, you just need to get a tight knot. I was going to make one. Yeah, here's one. Yeah, there's a theorem. This is the theorem that it exists. And you just pull it tight, see? And when you pull it tight, no matter what the rest of the chain does, it can't thread back through. There's no room. The blob, it's sort of isolated spatially. So here's a plug in the simple cubic lattice. And here's the Keston pattern you need, or one of them. There are lots of them. But this one, as you see, you go through here, and if you were to take each of these vertices, the thing about a self-avoiding walk is it's one-dimensional, but it generates its own three-dimensional space. It's just like it lives in California. So if you take each vertex, and you take each vertex is the barycenter of a dual three-cell, the Wigner-Seitz cell, and if you take the union of all the dual three-cells here, you get a three-dimensional ball. And you get this knotted arc on the inside. That three-dimensional ball is one that isolates this part of the walk from the rest of the walk. The rest of the walk cannot come back and penetrate the two-sphere boundary for the self-avoiding condition. So that means that if you've got this little tight knot in a long polygon, it's knotted. The rest of the polygon might make it worse, but it can't make it better. So you're interested in problems like this. For a fixed length, what is the distribution of knot types? How does this distribution vary within? What are the growth laws? And how do you quantize entanglement of random arcs? And one of the ideas is that here's some old work of Kendall, which proved for Brownian flight, if you take a tube of any length and any diameter, embed it in space anywhere you like, and do Brownian flight, sooner or later, you close both ends of this tube off with a disk. Sooner or later, the Brownian flight enters the tube, never to go back this way, goes through the tube, and comes out the other end. So what this means is if you wait long enough, you'll see all knots at all scales in Brownian flight. So the same sort of thing happens on the simple cubic lattice. I mean, I showed you the picture for the trefoil. Here's a picture for the figure eight knot. You can take any knot and do this. So there's a tight Keston pattern for every knot. So long random knots look something like this. You have big ones, and then on the big ones, you have little ones decorating them, and on the little ones, you've got smaller ones, and so on. So they get pretty bad. You can measure knot complexity as follows. If you take the set of knot types, call that script K. A good measure of knot complexity is a function that takes K to the non-negative real numbers, that takes the unknot, the round, unknotted open circle, to zero, and it's sort of additive. If you've got a connected sum of knots, knots have a structure just like the integers. There's this product or sum operation on them where you take a piece of string, you tie a knot in it, then tie another knot, and these two knots are sort of like atoms in this long chain. And there's a unique factorization theorem for knots, just like for integers. And so if you take one, that there is at least this one knot, so that if you take n copies of it, connect some, anything else, that this measure of complexity is at least this big. So it grows, and this part of it drives the growth. So we were able to prove that all good measures of knot complexity diverge to infinity at least linearly with the length, and that's straight out of Keston's pattern theorem. And the longer the random polygon, the more entangled it is. There are lots of good measures. These are all topological invariants of knots. Crossover number, a knotting number, genus, bridge number, etc. And you open a knot theory book at random, it's going to give you one of these measures. So the longer it is, the worse it is. So I'm going to now switch gears and talk about another project, one that involves looking at experiments on duplex DNA. So this is the Crick-Watson duplex structure for DNA. It consists of these two backbone strands, sugar phosphorus backbone strands, bound together by hydrogen bonding between the nucleotides. T is thymine, A is adenine, C is cytosine, G is guanine. A binds only with T and vice versa by means of a double hydrogen bond, and C binds only with G and vice versa by means of a triple hydrogen bond. So you get this duplex structure, and this is a picture of replication of duplex DNA. And as you can see, because the two backbone strands, Crick here and Watson there, because they are interwound, it means that the daughter molecules upon replication are themselves going to be interwound as well. And this is a problem for the cell. The cell has to overcome this entanglement, or otherwise it's going to die. So for the last 30 or so years, biologists have been interested in figuring out how cellular metabolism works. So they take DNA plasmids. Here's a supercoiled DNA plasmid. And you take a family of DNA plasmids. This is DNA 5 to 10 kb. And you take a test tube and you have isolated, say, a protein, one of these enzymes that acts on DNA. And you feed these this family of supercoiled DNA unknotted molecules to the test tube. And out the other side come a pattern of changed DNA. Here you see from this one to that one, that's a change in supercoiling. And from this one to that one, this one's knotted and this one's unknotted, that's a change in knotting. And from this one to that one, there may be two of these here that end up being linked or catenated together. And from this spectrum of changes in geometry and or topology, you like to deduce the mechanism of this protein that's in the test tube. You like to know how the protein binds to the DNA and what it does. Some of these proteins bind and break it apart and reconnect it, for example. So again, you're using circular DNA as a probe to detect something about how proteins act on DNA. So this protocol reacts circular DNA plasmids in vitro, sometimes in vivo, with purified enzyme. You then do electrophoresis to separate the knot products. Then you do electron microscopy to identify the topology on the nose. And then last but not least, you do a little bit of mathematics to build predictive models. So here's a picture of a gel. So a gel, this is agarose gel, so it's a sugar. And the DNA molecules are all negatively charged polyelectrolytes with a negative charge proportional to molecular weight. And so when you put them in the gel, you put them in a well at the top, so they're kind of in solution, and you put a pipette, you put them on the top, and you put a static electric field across the gel with a positive electrode down here. So the DNA migrates through the gel according to, well, if it's linear, it migrates according to its length. You can discriminate on the basis of single base pairs in terms of the gel velocity. So that's how you can do sequencing like this. if the DNA is all circular and exactly the same molecular weight. So they're the same molecules, they're just different by virtue of the way they're living in three-dimensional space. Like some of them are knotted and some of them are unknotted. Here's a picture of knotted molecules. This is the unknot. This is the three-crossing trefoil knot, the five-crossing torus knot, 7, 9, 11, 13, 15, 17, down to 23 crossings. These turn out to be T4 topoisomerase twist knots. That's the unknot. This is the trefoil. That's the figure 8 knot. This is the five-crossing torus knot, the five-crossing twist knot, 6, 7, 8, 9. So you get these discrete bands. This is a supercoiling ladder, so it measures the amount of supercoiling of unknotted DNA. So you can detect quite a lot from electrophoresis here. So here's an electron micrograph that shows you the technique for enhancing electron micrographs so that you can decode them. So this is circular DNA that's been coated with RecA. So RecA is a protein that mediates general recombination in E. coli. And if you take DNA and coat it with this protein, you can then see the crossings in an electron micrograph. So you can see that's over, this is under. So it's possible to resolve the crossings and detect the topology on the nose. Whereas if you have naked DNA, it's very difficult to resolve that crossing there, for example. So it's a very good technique for enhancing electron micrographs. So here's a picture of circular DNA. Turns out you have circular DNA in your own body. Your mitochondrial DNA is circular, for example. But this is a circular DNA plasmid that was converted from the unknot to this right-hand trefoil knot by an enzyme known as topoisomerase. This enzyme exists in cells, and its function is to detect and to fix topological entanglement. That you can actually have it produce topological entanglement. That's what happened in this experiment done in the Casarelli lab in Berkeley in 1985. On the other hand, if you were to go to the doctor and they took a picture of your DNA and it looked like this, you need to tell them about it. I mean, you know, if your DNA looks like this, you're in trouble. You're sick. So here's a 13-crossing torus knot. So it's from that gel I showed you with the 3, 5, 7, 9, and so on. This one was produced by site-specific recombination enzyme. So a recombinase, and the function of this recombinase, it's a viral recombinase. Its function is to splice the DNA of the virus into the DNA of the host. And if you do it on negatively supercoiled plasmid, you get pictures like this. The good news is that you don't have to have these pictures in order to detect the knot structure. It's possible to detect a lot of information about the knot by simply looking at the gel velocity. Gels are relatively easy to do. I mean, undergraduates do them in labs. Taking those electron micrographs, that's really hard. So if you've got gel information, it tells you something. So here's a paper from Alex Volgatsky and so on that talks about the ACN, the average crossing number of a knot of the ideal configuration, is linearly related to the gel velocity. So the faster it goes, the more complicated it is, and roughly speaking, the speed is directly proportional to the crossover number. So this is the information we're going to be able to use in this experiment I'm going to talk about. One of the interesting things that you can do in these experiments is detect chirality. So this is a right-hand trefoil. This is a left-hand trefoil. This is the mirror image plane here. Takes this right-hand coordinate system, and it changes the sign of the z-coordinate. The z-coordinate you can think of as the one coming out of the board. So if you want to get the mirror image, the mirror image of this picture, you simply change all the over and under information. It switches this one for that one. And these are two different knots. So these are the two enantiomers of the trefoil knot. Another thing you can measure that's a geometric measure of entanglement is the rive. And so if you take two oriented skew lines in space, there's a right-hand rule for the sign. So this is a plus sign. Take your right hand, put your thumb from the right hand on the overcrossing. If your fingers from the right hand go in the direction of the undercrossing, that's a plus crossing. If you change one of the two arrows or change over and under, you change the sign. So if you take, think of it as a rigid now configuration of a circle or an arc in space. Put an orientation on it. It doesn't matter how you do that. You take projections of it and then measure the signed crossover number, the projection, that gives you an integer. You average this integer over all projections, gives you a real number. That number is called the rise of the embedding. The higher the rise, the more non-planar it is. So it's a measure of non-planarity. So those concepts are going to come in this experiment where we're looking at viruses. So here's a virus that attacks potatoes. No, that's an E. coli cell. It just looks like a potato. There it is, yes. These are flying hypodermic needles. And the alien lives up here in this protein icosahedron. This thing attaches to the cell wall. This thing punctures the cell wall, and then the alien comes through the cell wall, and it gets into the interior of the cell. And the alien is duplex DNA. It's the virus. And this duplex DNA has sticky ends. So it's single-stranded on the two ends, kind of a 17 base pair overhang. These two ends are dual to each other, so the thing wants to become circular inside the cell. So here's a picture of T4. This produced that T4 topoisomerase, and you can see the icosahedron, the sheath, and the tail fibers. And there's a picture of cells undergoing a virus attack. So, you know, this is what happens when you get a cold. So this is why you feel so bad. And, you know, what happens if the virus decides to list the cell, what it does is it turns the cell into a slave factory producing copies of itself in this viral capsid structure. And then the cell explodes and dies. And then it goes off and infects other cells. We're interested in how the DNA is packed into the viral capsid. It's packed in there very, very tightly. And it's in a, you know, in 70 to 80 atmospheres of pressure. This DNA is fairly springy, and when you pack it in there, it really wants to get out. So it's packed in extremely tightly, and if you were to break the viral capsid, the stuff all squirts out like this. So we're interested in how this long bit of DNA gets packed into the small volume. So we'd like to know the packing geometry, and we'd like to be able to use some topology to help us with this problem. And there have been various models. This is the most reasonable model, is that it looks like a spooling model. Of course, there are other models of folded DNA, but of course, you've got real problems. If you're going to take the DNA and bend it like this, it's going to denature it. So that's going to require an enormous amount of energy to do that. And then, of course, there's, if you're a mathematician, what the heck? It might be randomly embedded. No biologist in his right mind would believe this. I mean, you know, if it's randomly embedded, how's it going to work? It's got to come out. If it's going to come out, it can't be randomly embedded. That's the end of my talk. No, it's not. Wait. I'm going to prove to you that it can't be randomly embedded. Okay. Well, here's a picture of the sticky ends. So that's the 17 base pair overhang. They become cyclic very quickly. What we'd like to do is to be able to take this DNA that's in this very tightly confined volume and release it to produce knots, and from the spectrum of knots, we'd like to deduce something about the packing. And so we'd like to compare this observed DNA knot spectrum observed via electrophoresis to a knot simulation, so doing random knotting in a box. So we're going to simulate knots in confined volumes, do random knotting in a box, and see if the spectrum is the same. And of course, it turns out it isn't. So that's the signal we're looking at. Here's some interesting information on viral knots. We'll be using the P4. It's a deletion mutant of P4. It's 10.5 kb. This is just finally at the range where you can do electrophoresis to detect knot types. These other DNAs, they're circular, but they're too big. If you run them in a gel, they'll break. So finally, you know, you finally get one short enough. And more than that, it produces 95% knots. This is an astoundingly high number. So it turns out that if you take, you do a random cyclization reaction on this very same DNA, we've done that, you get 3% knots. So this is in dilute solution. So it's all relaxed. You allow it to become cyclic in a dilute solution. You get 3% knots, and then mostly trefoil, three-crossing knots. 97% are unknotted. But if you extract this same DNA from the viral capsid, you get 95% knots, and they're of a very high complexity. The average crossover number is about 27, as detected by electrophoresis. So here's a picture of the gels. we had three kinds of DNA here. We had the mature phages. These are the ones that are infective. They're the ones with sheaths and tail fibers. And when you've got an infective one, one of the ends, one of those sticky ends, is glued down into the sheath. The other end is somewhere inside the capsid, and that's it gets injected. On the other hand, it's possible to grow these viruses in bacteria, and sometimes the tail structure fails to form. So these are the capsids, and you can, you know, get one from the other by cesium chloride centrifugation, and then you can break out the DNA, and you get these numbers. So you get some linear DNA, you get some unknotted DNA, then you get the knotted DNA. So in the mature phages, you get 47% knots. In these capsids, which is the same phage grown on the same bacterial stock, you get 88% knots. But it's also possible to take this same phage and grow it in a bacterium where the gene that codes for the tail fibers has a mutation. And that gives you these tailless mutants, and these are the ones that have, don't have tails, they never have them, and you get 95% knotting. And so 95 minus 47 is 48. So we deduce from this that 48% of these knots here are formed inside the capsid, that the two ends actually find themselves in this confined volume. And then the rest of them are formed in this globular phase before the DNA can relax. After you take it out of the capsid, the ends find each other, trapping some of the geometrical complexity in the form of knots. So here's a picture that shows you the information about crossover number. So the small knots, there aren't very many of them, and if you go over here, you see the big peak here is between 25 and 30 crossings. So very, very complex knots. And they're all kind of down here in this smear. The knots we know and love, the ones that have names, are kind of all up here. And the knots we get are the ones down here that are really pretty nasty. And so 97% of the DNA knots have crossing number bigger than 10, and the average crossover number is about 27. Here's a picture of a 2D gel that shows you topoisomerase digestion of these knots. As I said, topoisomerase takes knots and makes them better. It fixes them. It turns them into unknots as quickly as it can. So in a 2D gel, you run it, say, this way, and then you take the electrodes and put them on, then run it that way at a different voltage. Low voltage this way, high voltage that way. And that gives you kind of a better separation of the bands themselves. So here is the unknot. That's the trefoil. That's the figure eight knot, this little very thin spot. That's the five crossing knots, six, seven, eight, and so on. And then with the topoisomerase digestion, this is digestion after 1 minute and maybe 3 minutes here. You see that all these complex knots are turned into the unknot. These bands are getting darker and this smear is getting skinnier. So the digestion is killing all this complexity here and giving you very, very simple knots. And it turns out that after 4 minutes of topoisomerase digestion, you've basically killed all the knots, even these ones of 40 crossings. So we're looking at this two-dimensional gel to get information about the knot types. So these are the numbers. I mean, they aren't very large, but these are the ones that we can get a handle on. That's the unknot. This is the trefoil knot. This is the four-crossing knot, and it's very, very dim. So you see it's 0.02% of the knotted product, so it's much less than these other ones. This is the five-crossing knots. And then for the first time in the six-crossing knots, we see two spots. We claim that the second spot is where we're seeing composite knots for the first time, because six crossing knots is the first time in terms of crossover number that it's possible to have composite knots. These rest of them are prime knots. So we think that these are the square knot or the granny knot here. And then in the seven crossing knots, we see composite knots here as well. We see these two spots. So this is the first time composites are possible, and then we think it exists all the way down here. And these are the numbers. So what we did most recently, I guess, was to, when you're using electrophoresis to detect knot type, you have to use the duck theory. If it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, it is a duck. Because we ain't got no pictures. You know, I mean, we got to use electrophoresis here. So, and you can do electrophoresis on vanishingly small amount of product. If you're going to take those EMs, you've got to have one heck of a lot of product, and we don't have it. You saw how small those numbers were. So what you do is you take twist knots from previous experiments. You know that when you take T4 topoisomerase and react it with supercoiled, unknotted, negatively supercoiled DNA, you get twist knots. So this is a twist knot ladder. That's the unknot, that's the three-crossing twist knot, the trefoil knot, four-crossing twist knot, the figure eight knot, five-crossing twist knots, six-crossing twist knots, seven-crossing, and so on. We run this as a calibration, and then we do the two-dimensional electrophoresis here. We run it this way and then that way on this band. And here you see, that's the trefoil. Here's the figure eight knot, very, very faint. But you see that there's a difference in these five crossing knots. The twist knot would run about here. What we get is a knot that runs there, which is has to be a torus knot. So it has a lot of rise. And you go down here to the six crossing, that's a twist knot. But in the seven crossing band, you see that there's an offset between the seven crossing twist knot and the viral signal, so we conclude that this is a seven-crossing torus knot instead of a seven-crossing twist knot. The simulation is the one that you're all very familiar with. We use the crankshaft move on a freely jointed polygon with a number of edges corresponding to the length of the DNA. We use the Alexander polynomial as a knot detector. And the problem, of course, is that if you're going to simulate space-filling polymers in a confined volume, it turns out this is pretty hard to do. We're working on that as at present. But what you get is what you'd expect, that if you take a fixed chain length and reduce the volume, so R is kind of the radius of the box in terms of the number of multiples of the edge length, you go from 10 to 5 to 4 to 3 to 2, you see that the knotting probability goes up very, very quickly. And, of course, the average number of crossings you see in a projection goes up very, very quickly as you reduce the volume, as expected. But, of course, when you're doing these knots in a box, 75% of the crossings you find are extraneous. You've got a lot of extra crossings that you have to somehow get rid of if you're going to identify the knots. So in this simulation, here's the simulation up here. That here's the chain length. We did it, and this is what the one we focused on with a box of this size. If this is the chain length here plotting, you see the trefoil probability going up and coming down, the figure eight here, then the five crossing knots here. So in our simulation, we saw a lot of trefoils, but we saw a lot of figure eight knots. So these are random knots in a box, not many torus knots, and more twist knots than torus knots. These are the twist knots. These are the torus knots, five crossing. In the experiment, we saw a lot of trefoils, but very few figure eight knots, and a lot of torus knots, and virtually no twist knots. So this band doesn't correspond to this one. So this is what random knots in a box look like. This is what we got in the experiment. We conclude that what we're looking at isn't random. So what we did was put a rise fugacity on the simulation, just trying to install rise in there. And of course, what that does is you increase the rise, it drives down the achiral ones, and you pick up the chiral ones. The one with the most rise is this guy. And so you make it grow in at the expense of the twist knots. So this is kind of like the signal we see. So we believe that this shows that the packing in the viral capsid has rise in it, intrinsic rise. So we conclude that the viral DNA is not randomly embedded. We have a deficit of the figure eight and the five crossing twist knot and an excess of the five and seven crossing torus knots. We believe it has a chiral packing mechanism. And, of course, this should reflect the motor that had to put it in here. Motors that pack viruses have been found, for example, the simian leukemia virus, SV40. But the motor for this virus has never been found. People are looking for it, and there has to be one. I mean, it's too hard to get the stuff has to get in there with a big-time motor. And the motor would have to wrap things around like this. So we believe that these torus knots are a reflection of the motor that put it in there. The step we're trying to do now is to do electron microscopy or atomic force microscopy to see if the low crossing knots all have the same chirality. But we get pictures like this. What knot is that? Your guess is as good as mine. This picture was taken by Andrei Stasiak. So Stasiak's the guy that took those beautiful pictures of the trefoil and that 13 crossing Taurus knot. The difference is that those pictures were made at the ETH in Zurich, where he had a great lab and good shattering equipment. This picture was made in Lausanne, where he's now at University of Lausanne, and the shadowing equipment there and the staff in the lab aren't as good. And so he's the best guy in the world at making these pictures, and he can't make this work. So that shows you how hard it is to do this. It worked for him in Zurich, but it ain't working for him in Lausanne. Here's some other knots. We just have no idea what they are. We'd like to be able to decode them and claim they're all like plus this or plus that. We'd like to be able to detect the chirality and say that they're all the same chirality class. Can't do it. So Giovanni Dietler at the EPFL in Lausanne is also looking at this collection of viral knots and trying to do atomic force microscopy. But, these are better pictures, but, you know, you can't tell what those are. You know, that's probably just one crossing, but we can't make it work. We need to do the experiment again, gel purify the knots so that we know this knot came from the gel band corresponding to, say, five crossings. And if we know that, then all we got to do is figure out one of these crossings. It'll tell us the other four. Haven't done that yet either. This is why I'm a mathematician. Hell, this is hard. I mean, you know, being a mathematician, it's all on paper in a bar. So, you know. So I'll say just a word about a new simulation that Enzo is involved in. We use parallel tempering, and we're now trying to use the worm-like chain model to do the same thing inside a box. We've done it for freely jointed chains and get some nice pictures. Of course, this red line is down here below the red line is knots we can't tell what they are. And the trouble with making these knots is they're very, very complicated. You try to smooth them so that you can use some knot software to tell what the knot is, but sometimes it has way too many crossings even after you smooth it. So we're still working on that. So I'd like to thank all my collaborators. This is the SAP crowd, Stu and Bucks and Carla and Enzo and Chris Diao and Nick Pippinger. And these are the folks that did the experiment. Javier and Marielle were my PhD students who went while they were mathematics students, they went to Joaquim Roca's lab and molecular biology lab in Barcelona and were able to make this experiment work in 6 weeks, which is nothing short of a miracle. Paul McGuirk is an undergraduate at Berkeley who worked with Javier and Mariel on some of the simulations. And Christian Nicoletti and David Maranduzzo and Enzo should be down here as well. We're now working on another, taking the simulation to have volume exclusion in it. So with that, I'll be quiet and thank you very much.